Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is October 29th, 2014, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Everything You Know Is Wrong. So today's guest skeptic is Dr. Jeremy Faust, emergency medicine resident at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. And he's also the co-creator of a fantastic new podcast called Foamcast. Welcome back to the SGEM, Jeremy.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we're here at ASEP 2014 in Chicago, and last night we got to hang out with lots of FOAMED friends from around the world. And this has been my favorite ASEP ever.
Totally have to agree, but tell me, like, why? What's been for you the greatest?
Well, it's because it's been a wonderful father-son trip. My son, Ethan, took his grade 10 science fair project that won him the bronze medal for Canada and submitted it for the meeting. He created, designed, built, and tested a new spine board to quickly and accurately assess the weight of critically ill or injured children. Ethan is apparently one of the youngest people to ever be invited to present at ASEP. Jeremy, you can probably tell, I'm a really, really proud dad.
You should be. Lauren Westerfer and I had the chance to go hear Ethan give his talk, and we were like, whoa, this is kind of impressive. So Ken, big props. Congratulations.
Well, I know I'm always talking about being skeptical of anything, but I'm not skeptical of Ethan, and I've got a lot of bias in that area.
Fair enough.
So are you enjoying ASEP 2014?
Definitely been my favorite ASEP so far.
Well, what's been your favorite part then?
Well, you know, you alluded to the fact that a lot of FOAM people are here, and I just think back to like a couple of years ago when it was like literally 100 people tweeting, and I was looking at it, and now it's like close to 1,500 people tweeting, and now we kind of all know each other, so it's like a reunion. You get to meet some new people as well, so it's just been a great combination of old friends, new friends, and the content of the conference has been really great.
Well, I'm the EBM guy, and I'm the stats guy. You got anything like numbers to back this up?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. Thanks for the setup. So in 2012, according to Simpler, there was like maybe less than 1,500 tweets the entire week. The next year, 2013, it maxed out at 2,700 tweets per day and about 1,400 people tweeting, so a huge increase. And then this year, just on Monday alone, we topped 4,000 tweets in a day with 1,500 people tweeting.
I think I'm getting tweetitis in my thumbs because I'm having a hard time keeping up.
It's actually taking the pressure off of us. We can like actually listen a little more and tweet only the top things you want to tweet, because actually it's kind of everyone's got each other's backs. It's really nice.
Yeah, it's great that everybody's out there contributing. Last year we did a podcast though at ASEP in Seattle, and it was called The Five Stages of Evidence-Based Medicine Grief. Can you give us a quick summary of that podcast?
Absolutely. It was based on an article that I put in ASEP News, ASEP Now, now it's called, in which I talked about how people confront evidence-based medicine that kind of contradicts their practice, and the way they exhibit the five stages of grief, the Kubler-Ross stages of grief, which are denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and then eventually acceptance.
Well, Jeremy, you contacted me this fall and suggested we do another podcast on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine when we are together in Chicago. And I said, yeah, great idea, Jeremy. So what do you want to talk about this year?
So, Ken, I just recently gave a 15-minute talk at Mount Sinai called Everything You Know Is Wrong. It was part of a Mythbusters competition we're having in New York City. You know, I kind of figured rather than go after one of the myths that you've already dispelled here on the SGEM or things that Swami's gone after or Newman, I figured I'll go after the granddaddy of them all. So I chose the myth, the peer review process as we know it is good for science and medicine. Now, I know what you're going to say. It's like democracy. It's the worst except for every other system. But that being said, I really had a fun time questioning everything and realized that just because there are some good things that come out of the current process, there's actually a lot of bad too.
Well, I was surprised that you actually used a quote from Winston Churchill. I mean, you are an American. I mean, how about something from JFK like, freedom has many difficulties and democracy is not perfect. You could have modified that to, the peer review process has many difficulties and is not perfect.
Well, you're giving me way too much credit. But the point was to be provocative and to get people thinking bigger about how we can really change things in the future.
So did you rely on a paper to frame your myth-busting argument?
One of the papers I relied on, among many, was an older one out of the Annals of Emergency Medicine, in which the editors of Annals did something great. They concocted a fake paper that really would never pass the best evidence in emergency medicine criteria. I mean, you guys would have just blown it out of the water. And really, supposedly, the paper was supposed to be like an easy reject, so flawed that, in the author's own words, it should be, quote, unsalvageable. But a huge number of Annals reviewers actually either accepted the paper or said, well, make some revisions and then maybe it'll be good to go. They missed errors, small and, quite frankly, some biggies, too.
Okay, so why don't you take me through the peer review myth-busting presentation that you gave? And let's make sure everybody is starting on the same page. And if you could briefly explain standard peer review process. How does it work? What happens? Who are those peers? Who decides to accept, reject, modify? Just take me through the steps, Jeremy.
Well, basically every research starts with a question and people get their data together and then they submit it and there's a review board. For any journal, there's no real standard process for that. It's just whoever's on the board. Depending on the journal, sometimes it's a few reviewers or many, but there's no real quality control for that. They make their comments, they either accept or reject, and then it goes out there. And the problem with that is that there's really no quality control that's standardized. And I think that was one of the things that the Annals guys were trying to get at.
Well, I noticed that you had a quote in your presentation from Newman from the NNT. And the quote was, "The problem is that the New England Journal of Medicine is both the publication of record and Big Brother," end of quote. Can you explain what was meant by this quote?
I think what Dr. Newman's saying there is that even when you look at the top journals, the best ones in the world, you still have to think, you know what, this may not be good stuff. There might be some real huge flaws. And the problem is, a lot of the people on the review boards, sometimes they're associated with pharma, they have conflicts, and they have other motives that we might not even be aware of.
And then you used, you know, one of the most controversial things over the last 20 years as an example. You used autism and vaccines.
Yeah, my point there was that even in a journal as prestigious as Lancet, you can have terrible, terrible research that then goes out there and it's really hard to undo. So let me take you through it. In 1998, there's an article published in The Lancet saying there's a link between autism and vaccines. Now, it took years to undo this. And the funny thing about this is, within a couple of years, there were some non-peer-review panels that looked at this and said, that's junk, that's crap. But on the other hand, it's in the literature and everyone thinks, oh, it's The Lancet. So it really took a long time to undo that. It took until 2010, 12 years later, for Lancet to retract the paper.
Well, I'm always talking about the leaky pipe and that it can take greater than 10 years for high-quality, clinically relevant information to reach the patient's bedside. Now, this is an example of low-quality information, and it took over 10 years to get it out from the bedside. Now, there is a famous quote from a British neurologist, Dr. John Jackson, who said, quote, "It takes 50 years to get a wrong idea out of medicine and 100 years to get a right one into medicine."
That rings very true, I would say. So it's concerning because you think of like so many bad things that happened. The vaccination rates plummeted after this, and it's because it was in a huge peer-reviewed journal that everyone respects.
Yes, there was the logical fallacy from the argument from authority, and certainly The Lancet is an authority. Then in your presentation, Jeremy, you show five different reviewers' comments, and I want to thank you for picking my favorite number of five. But what did the reviewers say, and what point were you trying to make showing those five reviewers' comments?
So I'm happy to take credit, but Simon Finfer actually has a great talk from SMAC and in which he shows comments from five reviewers on a paper where he was a reviewer for a big journal. And what he wanted to show was that the first four reviewers were saying things like, this is wonderful, and congratulations, and that's a great paper, and publish. And he was the fifth reviewer who said, you know what, this is not even really good at all. And what happened there was, in the end, they needed all five reviewers to sign off on the paper going to press. And he was kind of, I would say, compelled to sign off on it because they made him an offer he could not refuse. They said, listen, we'll let you write a simultaneous editorial stating what your problems are with it, and then we'll publish it at the same time.
So it was simultaneously published paper, but wasn't that paper later retracted?
Well, so actually, it's worse than that. His editorial was simultaneously published in a different journal by the same publisher. So first of all, he got bamboozled. And then, of course, later on, when it was revealed that his concerns were both correct, the paper that he had problems with was retracted. All to say, of the five reviewers, he was the one who got it right, and the other four were wrong, and they were like, publish.
Wow. That's quite the story. Jeremy, who's afraid of peer review?
Well, I mean, that's the kind of what I'm getting at here. If this is the kind of discourse that's happening behind closed doors, I think we all might be a little afraid of peer review.
Yeah, but you say we. I mean, we're different, right? We're emergency medicine. We're different. We're the good guys, right?
Definitely, I think we are in general. But what I think is very interesting is the editors at the Annals of Emergency Medicine really wanted to be better. They wanted us to be better. So they started looking into whether our peer review process is actually better than other fields.
So who in the end reviews the reviewers then?
Exactly, and they found out that not really anybody. There's no real standard.
So is there a way that we can improve reviewers' quality?
Well, so far it's been really difficult. They've tried.
So what things have they tried, and what were the results?
They tried with written feedback, so they took some of their reviewers and they gave them feedback on various reviews they gave for papers that had certain problems. They tried that.
Well, what about taking those reviewers and having them attend a training session? Does that work?
Yeah, so that didn't work either. The written feedback didn't really help. Training sessions did not really help. It's really hard.
How about mentoring new peer reviewers? That must have worked.
Yeah, so they paired new reviewers just joining the review board with some of their best reviewers, people they really had respect for, and also, it just didn't work.
Oh, man. What you're telling me is three strikes, you're out?
Yeah.
Okay, so you wanted to talk about Big Pharma and that they're possibly cherry-picking positive results to publish?
There's two things in this talk that I discovered while I was making it. One is that Big Pharma, of course, we all know that there's people who are doing research and they're being paid for by Big Pharma. That's something we know. But what I thought was kind of interesting was there are reviewers who are on the board of various journals who are also being paid by Big Pharma, and they do not have to make their disclosures. They don't have to say, hey, I'm taking money, I'm a reviewer.
Wow, so the reviewers don't have to provide a conflict of interest statement. But how about conflict of interest in general? What happens if you release your conflict of interest disclosure? Does it have any impact on the peer reviewers themselves?
Yeah, the thought is that if you say, I've got these conflicts of interest, that somehow inoculates you against the problems. And I think, as we all know, that has not turned out to be the case.
So in your discussion, you came to the conclusion in your presentation that the emperor has no clothes. Could you explain that?
Well, this is an audio podcast, I'm just kidding. What I meant to say was, the linchpin, I think Dr. Callahan, who's the Annals of Emergency Medicine editor, he wrote, the linchpin of the peer review process is the peer reviewer. And if the peer reviewer is very low quality, despite all these different attempts that people have tried to make to improve it, then actually there's really no foundation there for the system that we're relying on. So that's what I meant, is that we're looking at something and actually there's not much there, unfortunately.
Well, Jeremy, I've been doing peer review for a number of years, and every time I peer reviewed a paper, I want to ensure the listeners I've been wearing clothes. So what's the solution?
Well, one solution I would say is we need to really rethink this system, and now is a good time to do it. I don't have one answer for this, but I think that some parts of the current system we have should definitely be retained. But I think that one of the things we can do is to have a lot of post-publication commenting like what you do on the SGEM.
Yeah, we just did a Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine Hot Off the Press, or SGEM Hop, and we got a tremendous amount of post-publication peer review at the speed of social media. So it was really nice to see, and I hate to use this quote, the best of both worlds. So you had the traditional model, and you had this newer model, and they were coming together to provide high-quality, clinically relevant information, but also cut that knowledge translation down, not to less than 1 year, but actually down to less than 1 week.
I was doing it in an hour because I heard it right after you published it. So there you go.
Excellent. Down to less than 1 hour. But Jeremy, can you give us a bottom line, a take-home message, something that people who are listening can take home or remember from the podcast?
Yeah, and I think you'll like this one. I would say just to be skeptical of everything, even peer review literature. When you pick up a new article, you've got to think the null hypothesis. This might not be true.
You're right. I do like your bottom line. Well, thanks again, Jeremy, for taking time from your busy ASAP schedule to sit down with me and discuss the process of peer review.
Hey, it was my pleasure. Anytime, good to see you again in America. One of these days, we're going to come up north.
Nice. Well, I want to encourage you to keep up the great work that both you and Lauren are doing on Foamcast. And if you've not listened to this new amazing podcast, you must start now. And as you always say, why foam it alone?
Yeah, we always encourage people to go and do the reading yourself and see what you think.
And again, this has been the best ASAP I've ever attended. And, you know, there's been many reasons, like being able to do another podcast with you, hooking up with all these FOMED friends, and making new friends. But ultimately, it's been a great trip because I've got to spend time with my son, Ethan.
Pretty solid performance by the Milne family, gotta say.
Well, we do have an upcoming conference with Ski Beam. It's 2015, January 26th to 28th in beautiful Sun Peaks, BC. But until then, Jeremy, thanks. Safe travels home. And can you give the SGEM tagline in your best New York accent?
Wow, this is going to be a test of my New Yorkness. I've been there almost 10 years now. All right. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on a Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Hey, get out of my way.
Talk to everyone next week.